KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
As a printer, I just get a real kick out of working with the machines because it requires the hand and the eye, and you can't just press a button and walk away. It's a sensory experience.
In that meeting, I clearly remember saying, okay, you guys are going to be huge. We'll just sit on the sidelines and watch. We'll get a little, you know, we'll ride your coattails for a little while.
Mudhoney's Mark Arm fantasizing with me about the meeting that Nirvana and Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, Mudhoney had in the late 80s, early 90s to decide how they'd change American music. Also, we're going to take a trip to a printer's, find out what a printer does these days in the world of digital and the internet. We'll also hear from Nick Bond, get a weather forecast later in the hour on weekday on KUOW Seattle. Thank you for helping us meet our goal. The drive is over. The programming continues. Thank you very much. We start with Jonathan Martin. Early stereotypes, you may have remembered, called the Gen Xers, Generation of Slackers. Matter of fact, that was even the name of one of the movies. Came out about the Gen Xers. Now, age in their 30s and 40s, some are wondering if maybe they should have pursued that slacking identity after all. Jonathan Martin writes a regular column for the editorial pages of the Seattle Times. His latest is titled, Gen X Retirees Will Have Less to Show. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Jonathan Martin joined the editorial board in January after 10 years as a reporter. You said it still has the new car smell.
Yeah.
He is also co-author of The Other Side of Mercy, A Killer's Journey Across the American Divide, about the Maurice Clemens story that the Seattle Times covered, as well as the rest of us. All right, so tell me something. You're a Gen Xer. You could have sat on the couch drinking PBRs and watching reruns of Ellen or Oprah. Didn't happen.
That's actually just a normal weekend for me.
Instead, you have worked. But you look at the economy and you wonder if maybe that was worth it.
I think that most of my friends believe that Social Security will not be there for us. And if you look at the big picture of the sort of the bedrock programs and promises for America, that's a pretty radical statement. But I think that, as I said in my column, that we seem to be in this era of deferred sacrifice and private gain. There really does seem to be an unwillingness to deal with the fact that America is up to its eyeballs in debt and wants and we expect to have a Cadillac level military. We expect to have historically low tax rates. We expect to have a broad framework of social safety net. And we expect to have a very good retirement programs for Medicare and Social Security. When you look at the framework, though, those promises are being eroded. And we do not seem to be willing to deal with where those programs will be for my generation. And the longer we delay that, the more the promise evaporates. And I think that that's a great level of concern, and I think you see that in the public polling of my generation. We are more anxious about our retirement than any other generation.
Why hasn't, and also we saw that in the debate, didn't we, in the last presidential election. I would think that Paul Ryan and Barack Obama would both say, look, we're responding to that concern. Are they not?
Well, there's clearly efforts to deal with pieces of our structural deficit and debt, and pieces of the Social Security Trust Fund deficit, and you know, it's just sort of there's these chunks of it. But do you really think that Congress is capable of doing something as large as, say, reducing military spending so that we're going to have money to reduce the college tuition costs that are my generation are going to be bearing with their children. Are we going to be able to deal with Social Security, the Social Security Trust Fund? We're talking about raising the age again. We're talking about the change to CPI idea. We don't seem to also be willing to even think about raising, scrapping the cap, which is another reasonable idea that would be
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Is this about the continuing political clout of the baby boomers, or maybe the clout of a senior lobby, a cohort of which changes all the time? But is that what this is?
Yeah, that's a good question. The reason this rant started brewing in me when I sat down, we were having dinner with my mother-in-law, who was talking, who's in her late 60s, she was talking about her concern that there was going to be any level of cut to Medicare and to Social Security as well. She said, you absolutely can't do that. And, you know, I just been thinking, I'm not even thinking it's going to be there for me at all. And you're talking about, rising up in arms for levels of cuts that are on the far, far margin. We all know that the retirees vote at rates that other generations don't, and dealing with Social Security and Medicare deficits are the programs are a third rail of politics. So yes, on one hand you have a tremendous political lobby, political force in the retirement and retirees. And the elder care lobby. And the other side, I think that my generation is not really looking at the consequences of today's decisions on us 25, 30, 35 years down the road.
Yet, aren't the Gen Xers, the early 30s to late 40s, aren't they moving into positions of power around the economy?
Yes. As I've said in my column, you know, there is a real entrepreneurial streak in my generation. I mean, Google, Twitter, eBay, you know, we'll even probably claim Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart.
Stewart? I guess Stewart would even.
Yeah, he's like late 40s, I think.
Yeah. Well, he calls himself an old man.
Yeah, we'll claim him. We are reaching the point where we are going to be the people in power. But the baby boom generation is this just.
Yeah,
massive.
We are hanging on, baby.
It's just a old gray elephant, you know, and obviously generations look after their own interests as well as hopefully the greater American experience. But as our generation does sort of take the reins of power, I think we should be trying doing it sooner than later, because I don't think the baby boomers are looking out for our best interests.
Jonathan Martin is a columnist and an editorial page writer for the Seattle Times. Based on overall wealth accumulation among 35 to 44-year-olds is 44% lower than our counterparts in 1984, so that would be the baby boomers. Also, we tumbled through the crash. Median age for a foreclosed homeowner is 44. And Gen X carries at least a third more home debt than baby boomers, according to the Consumer Expenditure Survey. How do you think the Gen Xers were approaching their middle years in their 20s, when they were in their 20s and early 30s? You know, so this is the slacker rap that was put on you guys.
Well, think about when I was started as a newspaper reporter in my early 20s, I quickly knew people that were going to work as book reviewers at this new company called Amazon. And if you think about the tech bubble, my generation really came out of college. First, it was, you know, I came out right at the tail end of the early Clinton administration, first Clinton administration recession. But then there was immediately the tech bubble. And you know, my generation were the code writers and the geeks that were taking advantage of that, and then poof, it all went away. And you know, so when we are now at the point of middle age where we have already had sort of our riches moment that maybe and then as we're now entering middle age or entering their 30s. I said we were buying our first houses, and all of my friends, we gauge our how much our house is worth by when did you buy it?
Yeah.
Because did you buy it at the very, very peak? And that means that your house is worth probably less than you bought it for. Or, so as we're approaching middle age now, I think, and retirement savings, we've already seen two bubbles. And that's part of the skepticism, I think, about the Social Security program, is that we've seen these things that seem almost too good to be true, and then poof, they go away.
What do you think your relationship is with the millennials at this point? Because that's you. The Gen Xers are sort of caught between two larger cohorts, right? The millennials are larger, and of course, the baby boomers are a larger cohort of American economic growth and policy. What's the relationship that Gen Xers have to the millennials?
Boy, I have just such a tremendous amount of empathy for the kids coming out of college now and are just, you know, looking at a bleak future as well. It's interesting, you know, the generational stereotypes, and I generally hate them, which is kind of why I started my column the way I did.
We are using all shorthand.
Mocking them.
Yes, it is mocking.
But, you know, there's a level of optimism among the millennials. Even I'm not sure how long that's going to last, the longer a terrible job picture will. But I think that I have a certain level of a tremendous amount of empathy for where they're at. And I think that we have really a shared interest in looking at the kind of the structural problems at the federal level for retirement, again for military spending, for tax rates, and the economy, and talking about sort of more of a sustainable approach that doesn't have everything, you know, all neatly wrapped into a bow at the very best possible level.
Do you think that the political dynamic this next election may have some more Gen Xers involved at running for higher office? Is there a way to shift the debate, the discussion, by, you know, people are going to chafe at this, the two younger cohorts against the older cohorts? I mean, is there a generational argument here to be made that the baby boomers have to be confronted with?
I don't mean to sound too sort of revolutionary or too pessimistic, but I feel like there is a generational war that is starting to brew. If you look at the cost estimates of caring of the elder care for the baby boom generation alone, and then you layer that on with how well that the baby boom generation has saved for retirement, which seems quite bleak. As I said in my column, this is a real hidden debt bomb. And they are not going to be, you know, Steve, when you retire, you know, you're not going to be able to
When I retire?
Well, yeah, we're journalists. I don't think we'll be working until. I think there really is a potential for generational war, because the millennials and the Gen Xers are going to be having to carry the load of a public healthcare system and publicly financed nursing homes and dealing with the Social Security trust fund debt deficit. Who else is going to be doing it? And right now, the conversations are all about the cost to the current retirees or the near retirees. And it's not, like I said, to the guys like me.
No, it's shifted onto you. It's always shifted on you all. We're not going to touch anybody who we made promises to, but the next generation, they'll have to shoulder more of the burden.
But as the size of the problem and as the size of the generation is vastly larger than they have been in previous generations.
Jonathan Martin's column, which appears regularly in the Times, was in the paper April 10th originally. Jonathan Martin, Gen X retirees will have to have less to show. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks, Steve. Good back.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:19, an inside look at the artistry of letterpress printing in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's Theater. SCT's 2013-2014 season showcases strong, resilient characters with several world premiere productions and adaptations of familiar stories, including Pippi Longstocking, the family musical. Tickets and information at SCT.org.
47 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. Expect a chance of rain this afternoon and a high today of 52. A conversation with Mark Arm of the legendary Seattle band Mudhoney, just 10 minutes away.
By the way, Jonathan Martin's column, just because it's all serendipity, his second or third paragraph, this is the idea about Gen Xers. Tattoos beneath suits, Mudhoney CDs stashed in the basement. Gen X instead is defined by its entrepreneurial streak, he writes. Just wanted to bring the Mudhoney into that as well, since we will in a moment. But first we're going to head down to what the press is like these days, the actual printing press. Hi, Katie Sewell.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you? The pledge drive's over. Feels nice. We're doing our first full show.
You're sitting in a different chair than you usually do.
I know. I feel awkward, but this is good. Yeah, the letterpress artist down at Evolution Press in Ballard sent us a sound of the day about a month ago. It was the sound of an original Heidelberg press.
I remember that sound. That was very nice.
Yeah, and I wanted to see these Heidelberg presses for myself, and I also wanted to understand more about the artistry of letterpress printing, which is, as digital printing rises, is going up, you know, is less regular.
Prevalent.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I spent the afternoon on the job with owner Scott Hill and printer Evan Christie at Evolution Press in Ballard.
Hi, I'm Scott Hill, and I'm the owner of Evolution Press here in Seattle.
And I'm Evan Christie. I'm a printer.
Evolution Press is a letterpress print room here in Seattle. We print with a lot of different print methods, foiling with ink or embossing.
Is what you do unusual?
I think it's unique these days. We use a lot of traditional techniques. So you've just entered our press room. So what you're looking at is a row of Heidelberg platens. And these are letterpress presses. They started building these in the 1930s. They're production presses, which mean, you know, in the letterpress world, they have automatic feed and delivery on them. So you can get a few impressions off. You're not doing one sheet at a time. They stopped making these presses in 84, but they still make other printing presses, offset printing presses.
As a printer, I just get a real kick out of working with the machines because it requires the hand and the eye, and you can't just press a button and walk away. It's a sensory experience.
We should mention that these are very large machines.
Yes, several thousand pounds. They're run by electric motors, but there's nothing digital on them.
Why use a press instead of a printer? Like in this modern computer age.
Digital printing, yeah. Well, that's a good question.
When you started, you were running offset jobs, and then you switched to this.
Why did you switch to this?
Oh, well, it's a little bit of in my background. I grew up in a printing family in New Zealand, and my family had Heidelberg letterpress platens in their shop, so I kind of grew up around it. And then after about 25 years in commercial printing, I guess I kind of went in the opposite direction and started working with letterpress again. It was like going back home.
Using your hands to make something, use a straight edge to draw a line with a pen, and using a blade to cut on that line to register artwork. I mean, it's a very satisfying kind of thing to do. You know, I'm not sitting at a desk all day. It smells like ink in here. You know, it's a good work environment.
So let's talk about these giant machines and one other aspect. I have to say, these are expensive.
They are, and like cars, you can buy a Beta, and this one's a 1950s Heidelberg cylinder. And they were built during a time that, you know, skills in machining were very high, so they were made to last.
And are people still making these kinds of machines anymore?
No, not for letterpress printing, no.
Are the parts still in existence?
There is a used parts market, yes. One of those things you have to get online and do a big hunt and talk to a lot of people, so it's a bit of a journey.
Are we going to run it?
We can fire it up. Sounds a bit like a train.
How do you fire it up?
Would you like to fire it up?
Sure. Okay. Why not?
You've got to grab this handle here and crank it onto running. So you've got to pull it pretty hard.
Pretty hard, yeah. Okay. You sent in for the sound of the day on the show?
No, that was one of the platens. But if we had been running a job that day when we sent it in, we would have sent you this one probably. It's pretty unique. What's really great is you get a different sound depending on where you are around the press. And as a printer, I'm listening more than I'm looking usually. Just because I can tell by the sound of the suction, what the sheet's doing. You have to be in tune with the machine, in tune with the rhythm of the machines, you know. It's part of knowing how to work them.
It's a good point. I always think it's like, you know, where they say it's flying by the seat of your pants. And it literally is when, you know, bush pilots, when they can, they're in those small bush planes and they can feel by the seat of their pants if something is changed or going is different. By hearing different sounds, you'll know right away if something's not feeding right.
What kind of a sound would be in there? Like, what would you hear?
Well, if it was going to misfeed, it would, you know, you can kind of hear the suckers going right now, and it's pretty consistent. And if it was going to misfeed, to not pick up the next sheet, there would be a pretty long suction of air, a sucking sound.
But it takes a trained ear. You might not hear it the first time, but...
We can hear the second ear. I'll do this again so you can hear it. Yeah, that's nice. I gotta shut it down now.
I think the brake needs some oil. Yeah. This is definitely... I think this is my favorite because it's almost has a life of its own when it's running and... It's just bigger, and so more is happening at once. Yeah.
How about you, Evan?
Well, the press that I use every day is one of the platens out there. I have a special place for that one in my heart, just because it's the reliable one. It's the first one I flip on in the morning usually.
Do you want to go demonstrate that one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
So this is the one that we sent you the sound of the day on. Got this nice, satisfying power button to turn it on.
Do you have to clean them somehow?
Yeah, you do. It has a wash-up blade in there, so if you put solvent on the rollers, the blade goes up against the drum roller, and it'll pull all the ink off automatically. No more than 10 minutes to wash up.
But as a printer, you have to appreciate the setup and the cleanup. As well.
Otherwise, you hate half your job.
it takes a lot of time. That's just part of what makes it special, though.
What are you looking for?
Well, like I said, you can't just press go and walk away. As the job's running, I'm looking for the color. I've set it up already, so some jobs are not very temperamental. Some are. You never really know what you're going to get, so that's another element of why it's challenging. Yeah.
The gripper bar is almost like, what, a part of a windmill.
And you've guessed it exactly right, because that's what these are, the nickname for them. They're called windmills, Heidelberg windmills.
Well, I noticed that to get this machine started, you had to use two hands.
Yeah. It's kind of like driving a truck.
You're a fairly young man. Do you think it changes your perspective on things to work around such old, very complicated machines?
Well, it was eye-opening the first time I came in here, but I'm the kind of guy, I had old Volkswagens in high school, and I feel like a Luddite most of the time. So I feel right at home in here. If you want to adjust something, you can turn a screw and fix it. I like that.
Is this an art form that will be around 50 years from now, do you think?
Oh, for sure.
Why?
Well, you know, it's been around since the, you know, mid-15th century. It slowed down for, you know, 20, 30 years. But I think there's always a need for, at least in printing, that pulls from the past, traditional methods of printing. I don't think those methods are irreplaceable. And so I just think there will always be a place for the traditional letterpress methods.
Thanks so much for talking to me.
Katie, thanks so much for visiting us here today.
The sound of a 1950s era Heidelberg press at Evolution Press. Katie Sewell was on the job in Ballard with the owner of Evolution Press, Scott Hill, and letterpress printer Evan Christie. Have an interesting job? We like to send Katie out on the job because, you know, we like to get her out of the studio.
It's good for her to do some real work.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have an interesting job, send us an email, weekday@kuow.org. Put on the job or job in the web subject line.
And I should mention that I'm not very squeamish. So if you want to get a little, you know, creative or daring, I'm down.
Bring it on.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the woman who liked to go to the hip surgery.
Yeah, the hip replacement surgery was awesome.
Yeah. There you are. She thought it was awesome. I thought it was interesting. This is Weekday.
Fair enough. It's 9:32, the music of Mudhoney, and a talk with singer-guitarist Mark Arm in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine's Weight Loss Surgery Program, performing weight loss procedures since 1978. The comprehensive multidisciplinary team at UW Medical Center is dedicated to finding weight loss solutions for every patient's newfound lifestyle and goals. UWMedicine.org/weight-loss.
47 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. It's going to stay cloudy today with a chance of rain this afternoon and a predicted high of 52. Tomorrow looks like it's going to be breezy with showers, chance of afternoon thunderstorms, and a high of just 50.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community, stewardship, and culture. Proud supporters of Woodland Park Zoo's science education and conservation programs. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
Thanks to all the new and renewing members who made KUOW's spring membership drive a resounding success. We met our goal, and it's because of your generosity, because you acknowledged the value of KUOW. If you didn't get a chance to contribute during the drive, it's not too late to get in on the excitement. You can do your part right now online at KUOW.org. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:33. A sound that might remind you not to take yourself too seriously in 10 minutes.
The music of Mudhoney, formed 25 years ago amidst the growing presence of rock and grunge bands like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. Mudhoney carved out a following for its music and style. While the band has stayed together, there have been some personnel changes. They've also taken a few breaks, and they've kept up their day jobs. Vocalist and rhythm guitarist Mark Arm is the warehouse manager at Sub Pop, the record label. We talk with Mark about the rock scene in Seattle in the 80s and 90s. Drug use was present. Arm used heroin for a few years, but unlike a few of his peers, he emerged relatively intact. Mark Arm grew up listening to Three Dog Night, Aerosmith, Sweet. He says he always gravitated towards the louder things. He developed a personal singing style and held on to it. And it was never about making money or becoming famous for Mudhoney, Arm tells us. It was always about making solid punk rock that might have kept them from flying below the radar that can bring down a higher flyer. Nirvana sold 30 million copies around the world, Mudhoney upwards of about 500,000 total. But Mudhoney has outlasted their contemporaries. Nirvana, and tragically, Soundgarden has only recently surfaced again. Mudhoney never quit making music. They've released 9 albums over the last 25 years. Their latest, Vanishing Point, came out last week.
I kind of think of the early years of Mudhoney as being, that was my early retirement. You know, I didn't work for about 10 years and, you know, got to travel the world, and I was lucky I was able to do that. It wasn't a goal necessarily, you know, when I started playing music. Like, I cut my teeth pretty much in the hardcore punk scene of the early 80s. And the idea that any of those bands were going to be huge, big sellers, you know, was ridiculous. The limit was pretty much the Dead Kennedys or Black Flag, you know. And those bands never became, like, you know, platinum sellers or anything like that.
Was the goal during the punk scene to sell records?
Yeah, I think the goal was to have fun. And also... And for us, it was to entertain ourselves and each other.
Yeah, you were talking to your bass, weren't you?
Yeah, well, that was kind of the amazing thing about hardcore. Like, if you're 19 years old, there's a band of 19-year-olds on stage. And, you know, if they're local, you knew everyone pretty much. It was a very small scene here in Seattle. And the idea that, you know, it would go beyond that or very much beyond that, didn't cross most people's minds.
Tell me something. Do you use labels like alternative or grunge, which I believe you... Do you get the credit for that? Do you get a little trademark?
I hope I don't get credit for it. People have been trying to force that credit on me, and I don't understand where that came from. Maybe someone posted on Wikipedia or something.
That's a good one. But do you... So you're not taking even claim for that. Do you use those labels, though, in your music? Do you say, I'm a punk rocker, I'm a... XYZ?
You know, when people ask what kind of band we have, I just generally, and they know nothing about, you know, the small little categories and genres and stuff, I just say we're a rock band.
You don't say, well, we're like Three Dog Night.
No. That would be good.
I ask because sometimes musicians say, don't call me a jazz musician or a folk musician.
You know, if I identify with any kind of music, I think it would be with punk rock. But I think the way people look at punk rock or think what punk rock is has shifted since that mid-90s explosion of punk rock bands from California like The Offspring and Green Day. Or Blink-182, I mean, that has... absolutely nothing to do with what we're doing, you know.
Yeah, how far are they from the 80s punk rock bands or the late 70s punk?
I don't know. They're just like another form of a big production pop band.
Did you ever want to go that way? Big production pop band?
No.
How come?
It just never appealed to me. I don't like hearing it. I don't want to play it.
Except for the Three Dog Night again.
Well, I liked hearing it when I was when I was 8.
what do you think of this album? How do you like this album, Vanishing Point?
I'm very happy with it. It's hard for me to...
Wait, you don't get to ask me that.
No. It's just hard for me to, like, really be objective about our stuff, you know?
Sure. That's why I was wondering how you... But you like it.
Yeah. I like the final course, which has no chorus at all. It's just sort of a story that goes through the whole thing. Also, in this Rubber Tomb, both those songs, they kind of, to me, have sort of a proto-punk feel. Like, they kind of feel like they could have come from a band like Rocket from the Tombs in 1976 from Ohio. That band became Peru Ubu and the Dead Boys. Like, they split in two, and one became more avant-garde, and the other went more straight-up punk rock.
Mark Arm is the vocalist, rhythm guitarist for the alternative rock band Mudhoney. I like that alternative rock band phrase.
Yeah, I don't really like it because it makes it seem like we're an alternative.
You're like outside.
Or, you know, I prefer underground. maybe.
Well, I bet that sounds much cooler.
Alternative just seems like alternative music seems like it's not real music. Like, I don't like the term indie because that just sounds really inoffensive and effete, you know? I like the word independent, you know? I just said you know like eight times.
When you all in 1992, or 1990 rather, sat down, you and the folks from Pearl Jam and the folks from Nirvana.
And, when we had this meeting?
Yeah. When you sat down and had the meeting and decided, we're going to bust out music from Seattle. What were you all hoping that you were achieving with that?
In that meeting, I clearly remember saying, okay, you guys are going to be huge. We'll just sit on the sidelines and watch. We'll get a little, you know, we'll ride your coattails for a little while, but that'll be cool.
But your fans stuck with you, even though you made that deal with the devil.
I can only, man, it's amazing how little you get once you make that deal with the devil.
That's why, I mean, you never stopped, though. You guys kept putting music out.
Yeah. You know, and I think there were a couple things that happened at the beginning of the band that were just sort of lucky accidents that kept us going for a long time. Because when we first started, our initial goal was to release a single, which we did. And we kind of thought, like, you know, maybe we'd be a band for 3 years because that's how long Green River lasted, you know. But we decided to credit all the songs to the band, split everything equally. So there wasn't any friction on that level in the band. And there haven't really been any, like, ego power plays or anything like that.
So later, when you had that second meeting in like 1998, and Pearl Jam and Nirvana were all
Nirvana was not at that meeting.
Yeah, none of them. They were gone by then.
Well, Pearl Jam was around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the guys from Nirvana, I should say the individuals,
the remaining members.
You could look at them and say what? Well, at least we have our what?
We still have a band. I don't know what you'd say.
Oh. You never did sit and talk in all those years? I mean, you guys played together sometimes or played in similar venues and the like?
Sure. We were friends with people in all the bands that became big out of Seattle, you know. Alice in Chains is probably the band that we knew least, but we knew those guys. They didn't really come up through the same, like, hardcore punk scene that the members in, like, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Nirvana came up through.
Right. I left Soundgarden out of the meeting, didn't I?
Right. Yeah, yeah. They were key players.
Yeah. How do you look back on that time?
You know, I don't really think about that time very much, except right after we have a new record and
that's all we get asked.
I'm doing a bunch of interviews.
And everybody says, well, I don't mean how you think about the time. That's a separate question. I mean, how do you think back on the music that emerged during that time? Because there was obviously some kind of ferment that all us folks living here shared.
Sure. I don't really listen to that music. I don't listen to our records. I don't listen to those records from that time. I mean, that music was just everywhere. So I kind of feel like I know it. If I want to hear something that's really going to make me feel good, that is going to bring back fond memories or something, it's going to be like Discharge or The Stooges or Perubu or something. It's something that is more imaginary to me than something that was like so concrete and all over the place.
So it was imaginary in that it was,
well, it was
your,
like,
youth.
Yeah, I was just like listening to it and kind of felt new and trying to just sort of picture where this music came from instead of, you know, something that was part of an environment that I was actually in.
I get that. I lived here then. I didn't listen to the music.
To which music?
Your music. I didn't listen to it. It wasn't talking to
me. Why would you? It's crap.
You don't think it's crap. You don't think that.
No, it doesn't matter if I think it is or not.
No. In that what? What do you mean by that?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm saying I didn't listen to it. I wouldn't call it a name. I just was thinking about being attracted to something or not being attracted to something in that time, in that era. I mean, we're not that far apart in age. I'm probably 10 years older than you. But it's not about age, right? It's just about...
It could be
whatever
about age. It could be about whatever grabs you. You know, there's probably plenty of people who were my age who didn't like what we're doing. In fact, as a matter of fact, I know there are a lot of people who are my age who didn't like what we're doing, you know.
Would they come over to your house later? What do you mean?
No, but, you know, it didn't speak to them.
But what I but the reason I asked this is because for you, you were
you
fine.
Know we were on
you were fine with that
in at kind of the height of grunge, whatever you want to call it.
When was this?
I don't know, like maybe 92 or whatever. That single soundtrack came out, and that, you know, I have a platinum record. That's my only platinum record, is the soundtrack that we were on. So that sold like at least 1 million copies. And our record that came out about the same time was Piece of Cake, and that record sold about 150,000 copies. So my take on that is like 1 million people heard us and 850,000 said no.
You know, it's an interesting thing about that, isn't it? It reminds me of an athlete. You have to hone your craft, practice your art, even though, like a baseball player, you know, if you're hitting 300, you're a great ball player. Artists don't get that quite that same thinking, but that's really what's, in a sense, what kind of happens, isn't it?
If people are ready to hop on board and get into it, that's great. But if they're not, then there's nothing we can do about it, and we're not concerned with it.
Well, but some bands do something different, right? They search out the hit rather than hope they have a hit.
Well, that's an approach to music that doesn't appeal to me at all. To me, the idea that playing music isn't an end to itself, but is like a way to achieve a goal, you know, to like, I'm going to get wealthy, I'm going to be famous or whatever. You know, if you start thinking about music in those terms, then chances are you will be bitterly disappointed, because only a few bands or artists can even get to that stature.
Did you always have that attitude when you were starting out? When you guys were first?
Since I've been playing music, yeah.
Because you did see other people who took other routes, or, I don't know, I did not know Kurt Cobain, perhaps you did, but was he one of those people who was wondering what his path was towards the end?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, he's definitely wondering about something towards the end. I can't speak for him.
You guys didn't know each other. We
knew each other, you know.
Yeah. You lost your own band, I mean, right? You had your own friends in music that you lost over the years for different reasons, all sorts of different reasons. I know that.
Yeah. There's, you know, I think by the time you get to be our age, you have lost a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Harder life in music than broadcasting, though, I think.
No, but, you know, I don't know. People of all walks of life do drugs.
Yeah. Can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
We're doing an interview. Mm-hmm. You had some interview where you said, yeah, I smoke pot sometimes, but I, you know, it'll usually leave me laying on the couch. But it got me thinking about heroin.
Right.
The appeal of heroin. And I also noticed that you wrote, well, I would quit it or go back to it as you saw fit for a chunk of time. What's the appeal of heroin?
It feels good.
Always?
It's been a long time since I've done it. You know, I'm trying to think back to like, you know, the last time was summer of 93. I mean, to me, I did drugs for about, you know, the really hard drugs for about 5 years. And like maybe two of those years, it was a serious addiction. And I was in the Boy Scouts for about 5 years and I became an Eagle Scout. To me, I look back at my life and it's like, oh, those are two weird things that I did. You know, at this point, they just kind of seem removed from my reality. You know, I don't tie knots all the time. And I couldn't tie a bowline right now if I had to.
Or hit a vein.
Well, I could probably. I mean, that's simpler.
Boy, I heard you say, or I read that you said that for you, when you, it was like the sniffles or a bad flu for a few days.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
When you left
When you stopped. Yeah. I was used to quitting because no one else in, we toured a lot and no one else in the band did heroin, and I knew that they would be really upset if I did on tour.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Was it hidden from the other band members?
Oh, you know, I probably thought it was. But, you know, I think after a while, people, they, you know, they knew what was going on.
I guess I'm mostly curious about the culture or the appeal. I mean, you have known many musicians. I mean, we know of many musicians for whom heroin, jazz up to today, for whom heroin becomes sort of like, I don't know, underground, revolutionary, also a response.
Yeah, it's about the least revolutionary thing you can do. It's same with like smoking, you know. I mean, actually smoking is probably less revolutionary because
that's major corporations are selling those things to you. But, you know, if you're putting on a rebel pose and you're smoking a cigarette, you're a
But something must have got you at some point thinking, oh, I'll try this.
Well, I think I'll tell you what got me thinking that, like, that's maybe not going to be that big of a deal was I would go all the way back to, like, drug education in elementary school. It's, you know, you get taught that, like, marijuana is this horrible, horrible thing, and even psychedelics are this horrible, horrible thing. And, you know, eventually, like, tried, you know, in the 70s, kids were smoking pot a lot. And so, you know, I tried it then. And then, like, later on in college, experimented with psychedelic drugs and kind of actually felt for a while that this is pretty revelatory and, you know, did have my mind expanded. And it wasn't, like, as terrifying as I thought it was going to be. This may not be the message you want to put out on the air. But so then when you get to the point where, like, the opportunity to try this other drug, oh, sure, why not? It wasn't these other things that I tried weren't what they were telling us as kids how horrible they were going to be. You know, in elementary school, as soon as you took LSD, you would die. That was kind of the fear level of it.
Do you think that message sort of that notion, what's true and what we're being told, that sort of permeates your music, doesn't it? Your lyrics in some ways, that idea of here's...
I don't know if it permeates it. It's there.
Well, permeates is too strong. It's there, yeah. Permeates would mean it was in everything.
You have to kind of come to your own conclusions about things, I think. I feel like I'm the kind of person who needs to experience things. Maybe I learn lessons the hard way.
What do you do now? I don't mean drugs. I mean, what do you do now? Experiencing things. What are your pleasures today?
I like to go surfing.
In Washington State?
Yeah, yeah.
In the cold waters?
Yeah.
You're a strong man.
I'm not that good at it, and I don't get to go nearly as often as I like, but I really like getting out there, and there's some remote places that are just so beautiful and gorgeous. You know, just sitting in the water, you see, like, sea lions and eagles and hardly anyone there. It can be that way sometimes. And
that sounds nice. Where do you go? Oh, that sounds great.
I can't tell you.
Oh, because then I'd know. Huh?
Yeah, well, other people who are listening.
Actually, if you're surfing in the surfing culture, you probably can't tell me, can you? Isn't that sort of it's like Fight Club, I thought.
I mean, there's some places, you know, where everyone knows you can go to, like, you know, Westport or something like that.
Yeah. What else do you do that you like? I mean, I know you continue to make music.
Yeah, I continue to make music. I like to hang around. I like to drink wine.
All the regular stuff you do when you get old.
Yeah, yeah. Hang out with my dogs, my wife, you know.
The regular people.
Yeah.
So what keeps you... That's a far cry from the revolutionary punk rocker notion, but you still make the music. So what keeps the music fresh for you into your age today? You know, your old dotage. What are you, in your 40s?
I'm 51.
51. So your dotage, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what exactly keeps it fresh. I don't have an answer that I can just pull out and say, this is a magic formula, you know?
Because that's what I was hoping.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wish I could distill it and bottle it and sell it, yeah. You know?
But it stays fresh for you.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it.
It's not just carton records around the Sub Pop warehouse either, right? That keeps it fresh for you.
There is no greater joy than boxing up records and sending them out.
So what does keep it fresh for you, do you think? I know you don't have no pat answer, but what's keeping it fresh for you?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that keeps it fresh for us at this point is the fact that it isn't our main thing. It's a treat that we get to be able to do this. And I feel like we're very lucky that people are at all interested in what we do and that we get to go to very cool places around the world. And it's not... It doesn't feel like an obligation. Like, there were actually maybe a couple years in there in maybe the mid-90s where it's just sort of like, we have to do this. Like, we did a record. We have to do another one. So, and then we have to go tour to follow that up. And that's our source of income. And now, you know, we're free of that.
It's Mark Arm, vocalist and rhythm guitarist of the band Mudhoney. Their latest album, Vanishing Point. A little more from Mudhoney. In a few moments. It's weekday. And now.
This is the sound of the week. Sound of the week.
Oh, While cruising down I-5, listener Jerry stopped in Chehalis. He walked into a clock shop right before noon. Jerry said his friend Georgia always had a cuckoo clock. He's reminded once an hour to not take himself too seriously. What interesting sounds are you hearing? Not take yourself too seriously. Record 30 seconds of it, would you? And send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Oh, I think I've been in that store.
That's... Maybe I can use that on the air at noon.
Yeah, you should. You should, Bernard. Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us with a weather outlook for the rest of the day and the weekend. Hello, Nick.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I hear we're going to have more rain.
Yeah, so while it's a good morning, the afternoon is not looking quite as good, weather-wise at least. There's some rain starting up on the coast, and it's headed our way. And the rain this afternoon and some showers this evening probably get kind of breezy tonight also. So we have that to look forward to. And then for Saturday, plenty of showers, again, kind of on the breezy side. And there's a chance some of those showers, the heavier ones, will include some small, soft hail. So we can look forward to that. And maybe even a slight chance of a rumble of thunder or two, but just a slight chance there. Going into Sunday, still some more showers, probably not as much rain in most spots, but definitely kind of a cool, wet weekend. Snow in the mountains below past level. So,
what's this?
Welcome to spring in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, what's this reason for this storm system?
You know, it's part of our climate, basically. It's not unusual at all to have this kind of winter hang tough into, well, early April and sometimes even a little beyond.
Is it? It's coming from the southwest, though. It's coming off the ocean.
Well, it's coming off the ocean. This system actually more from the west or even northwest.
And I
so
see.
It's bringing some pretty cool air with it. And our high temperatures this weekend are only going to get around 50 or so. So, you know, summer is a ways off.
Bundle up. Lots of mudslides this season. And so the Washington State Climatologist Office was asked to look into how this season is stacking up with previous ones. What have you found?
Right, yeah, and it's what we've done is looked, tried to estimate just how much has rained between Seattle and Everett, where a lot of these slides have occurred, and there was, in fact, even a derailment of an Amtrak train last weekend. Well, luckily, no injuries, but anyway, as near as we can tell, there's no real nearby station. It's gotten about 4 or 5 inches more rain than usual going back to November, mostly because it was pretty wet before the first of the year. But we also counted the number of days with substantial rain here. Just we picked a half an inch as being an especially soggy day. And in that spot, there usually is about a dozen of those days in a winter. And this past one, depending which station you look at, it's been 12 to 19. So it has been wetter than normal, but I want to emphasize not exceptionally so.
You've said that parts of our landscape are inherently unstable and still adjusting to the sculpting by the glaciers from the last ice age. Can I assume that parts of that landscape includes along the shoreline of Puget Sound where these tracks run?
Well, yeah. And there was a big slide in Whidbey Island recently. And so, yeah, that's part of the deal. And, of course, when we start monkeying around doing things like clear-cutting and development and various things, we can interfere with that and sometimes make it worse. But, our landscape is kind of inherently unstable in some spots, and they're just going to be prone to sliding.
All right, Nick. We'll stay warm, and we'll stay out of the way of slides.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Nick Bond is a Washington State climatologist, works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. With that in mind, a little mud honey, because we'll sing this song of joy.
sing this song of joy from Mudhoney's new album. You can hear Steve's interview with Mark Arm, vocalist and guitarist of Mudhoney, on our website, KUOW.org. We'll get an update on what's happening with North Korea in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting the National Theatre of Scotland's production of Black Watch, the international play based on Gregory.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.